Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Let me just start with this. You know, there's a sense that the private sector should be stepping forward and doing these things on its own, that when it comes to China's attempts to dominate high-tech industries, that market engagement should be outside the scope of government's role. I would ask you, Mr. Atkinson, what are the drawbacks to such an approach?
That's Marco Rubio. He's a senator, chair of the Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship. He's probably going to run for president again someday. But here he's speaking in a committee hearing. It's one of the smaller ones. Senators are polite and they're curious and then they leave. I went. I stayed until the end. And when almost all the other senators were gone, Rubio quietly, briefly, barely wondered what government can do to help business.
This is not a small U.S. business competing with a small Chinese business who see who has a better idea. This is a small or mid-sized U.S. business trying to innovate and compete against a potentially small firm backed up by a nation state with the second largest economy, soon to be largest gross economy in the world. That's not a fair fight. So what is the drawbacks of not having some level of government engagement, not industrial policy, we're doing the same things they're doing, but the sort of things we've discussed today, allowing them access to the U.S. government, being their customer, you know, that sort of thing.
This is Alpha Chat, a project from the Financial Times and the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance at Brown University. I'm Brendan Greeley. I'm the U.S. editor for FT Alphaville. This week, we're not talking about a U.S. trade deal with China, really. We're talking about a new trade relationship. America needs some kind of deal. So does China. But when that deal is signed, you still have on one side of the Pacific a country with an industrial plan called Made in China 2025 to start making technically difficult things like airplanes. On the other side of the ocean, you will still have a country that already makes those things but doesn't like the idea of an industrial plan and so doesn't have one. That was, in fact, the title of the hearing, Made in China 2025 and the Future of American Industry. Brad Setzer was a witness at the hearing. He's at the Council on Foreign Relations. If you're in finance, he is the person you read to understand capital flows among nations. He worked at Treasury during the Asian crises and again during the Euro crisis. At the committee hearing, he testified that it's unrealistic to expect that China will always be okay with being a low-end, cheap labor manufacturer. We sat down with Brad in D.C. and asked first what he thinks the conflict is.
I think there's a sense, I think it's a correct sense, that China rigs its internal markets in ways that favor Chinese firms, in ways that penalize imports, particularly in manufacturing sectors, and in ways that are sort of structurally designed to favor those foreign firms who are willing to move their operations and, in some case, their technology to China. You can look at a large number of measures. And particularly after the global financial crisis, China just doesn't import that many manufactured goods. It imports a lot of microchips for cell phones, which are then re-export, and a growing share of those phones are still used in China. But if you net out the imports for re-export, China's manufactured imports as a share of GDP are quite low, 5%, and they've tended to fall over time. I think that's the statistical evidence that goes with the basic story that it is hard, if you're a foreign company, to sell into China. And in order to sell into China, you often have to do a deal with, in some sense, the Chinese state, get on the right side, make sure that the Chinese state enterprises who you're selling to want to buy from you, and in often cases, form a joint venture with a Chinese state enterprise that can kind of be your guardian protector inside China.
And so the problem is then that China wants to move up the value chain. Mm-hmm. They want to produce stuff that's harder to make, mm-hmm. Which is something they haven't been traditionally very good at. So they have a plan. When we talk about this plan, Made in China 2025, it's what you're going to testify about today on the Hill. Is that manifestly different from the system that you're already talking about, where traditionally there has been state support for some industries. There has been discouraging, it's just been difficult, regulatory hurdles, cultural hurdles, all sorts of reasons why it's been very difficult for foreign companies to find markets in China without sharing their technology. Is Made in China 2025 all that different, or is it a scary phrase?
Well, it is a continuation of a lot of different Chinese policies. It's an evolution in that sense. It's not like China came up with the idea that it would just start subsidizing investment in pick your sector. And once a Chinese company developed in that sector, lo and behold, a lot of Chinese firms would buy the product that had been developed by the state-supported firm. That's broadly speaking, that's a story which you can see, say, in high-speed rail over the past 10 years, in wind technology over the past 10 years. It isn't new in that sense. What I think is new is that China's economy has developed, it has progressed, it has moved upward in its technological capacities. And so China now is aiming, if you take China 2025 on its face, to displace imports in some sectors where there was no realistic possibility of displacing imports before. Most obvious and most significant to the U.S., aircraft, semiconductors, top-of-the-line medical equipment. Those are big parts of the American export base.
Yeah, those are what you just named are sort of three of the top seven exports to China from the United States.
Correct.
And I wonder sometimes whether that's something that's properly appreciated politically within the United States. Is that we tend to look at a static thing where furniture manufacturing went away and went to China. Clothing manufacturing went away and went to China. What I don't think is completely clear politically within the United States is that machine tooling in the U.S. is a thriving sector. It works. There's still employment in that sector. There's still exports in that sector. It's still something where the United States is better than a lot of other countries at making industrial machines and tools. That's at risk now, too.
Look, China 2025 may not succeed. It may produce aircraft that not even the Chinese state airlines are really willing to buy, in which case it won't turn out to be all that big of a threat. But if China does succeed at producing a competitor that's reasonably efficient to the Boeing 737 and the A320, that will displace the biggest single export of the United States to China. What that means over time, I think, is a less intense trade relationship. If China is not going to buy the products that we are best at, they're necessarily, in a Paul Samuelson-style equilibrium, will be less trade. How you get there is a complicated question. But it also, it is a challenge, not just to those workers in those sectors, but also increasingly to U.S. technological leadership. China isn't there yet, but China aspires with state-backed companies to be at the cutting edge of most manufacturing industries.
Is it fair to say that that's the biggest threat? If you're an American and you have no compunction about being a protectionist whatsoever, that it's that possibility of China becoming better at making these more difficult to make things, airplanes, cars, medical equipment, that's the biggest threat to the American manufacturing base, that's the challenge now.
Yes, I think that is the challenge. And then I think from you can think of some broader challenges, which we could get into, about potential dependence on China and Chinese state companies to supply parts of our critical infrastructure.
One thing I wonder about, though, that if that's the central challenge, that's a definitional goal for the Communist Party and for ordinary Chinese. Moving up the value chain is incredibly important. It's something that they see as intrinsic to their own economy. It's something that they see as a point of national pride. And it's something that you can't really begrudge them on. Is there a remedy when the thing that a country in its heart desperately wants, and you could make a case that they deserve to have, is the thing that's most threatening to you? How could you come up with trade rules that would mitigate that?
If this is going to be a substantive deal, it's a very difficult deal. I think the easiest one to think about conceptually is civil aviation aircraft. You can certainly see from China's point of view that China would like to have its own airplane.
Yeah.
Chinese leaders would like to fly around the world in an airplane that is made in China. know, they're a long ways away from that unless they want to fly on a narrow body. And most people like flying in a big, impressive four-engine jet, and that means a 747. And those who can't fly around in a 747 generally want a 777 or one of the bigger Airbuses. And not too many heads of state feel proud, maybe Lopez Obrador in Mexico, about flying around in something that's about a 737 size. It sort of makes you seem like a small nation. So China's a long ways away from that. But you could see why China and the Chinese leadership might say a civil aviation industry is something that a great nation like China should have. And the global market is too duopolistic. Boeing and Airbus divide it. That's unfair. They just had a historical first mover advantage. Let's catch up. Problem is, that is actually an important source of employment and exports for the U.S. And if that...
I mean, it's massive. It's when you look at the trade statistics in terms of what we export, as a share of our exports, it's huge. It's our single biggest export to China, but it's also our single biggest export anywhere.
Correct. It is at the core of the modern U.S. manufacturing exporting economy. It is a central source of American technological leadership and remaining manufacturing excellence. So if China succeeds, it necessarily means almost fewer U.S. exports. Certainly fewer U.S. exports to China, fewer U.S. exports around the world, and some subset of adjustments. Now, we accommodate those kinds of industrial shifts in most sectors. It's a little harder, though, to understand and to accept, if you're a worker in the aerospace industry, when it is clear that you're competing, in some sense, against China's state. China's state has set up the manufacturing companies that are making aircraft. China's state is providing the financing. China's state, in the first instance, is guaranteeing demand. The big three airlines in China are all state-owned. And China's state will provide export financing. The ground rules of competition seem unfair. And I think that's the core difficulty, something that Martin Wolf, your esteemed colleague, has called two systems, one world. How do you establish ground rules for fair competition between two economic systems that are so different as those two systems converge towards a similar technological level?
The approach the United States has taken thus far in the last year has been the deal-making approach, to apply pressure and then see whether a deal can come out of it. Would the U.S. be better off making a legal approach, saying, okay, we cannot deny you your manifest right to make a plane that you can ride around the world in, but we can bring a WTO case for absolutely every violation, every bit of state support, every bit of IP theft that we see? Is there would that be potentially a more effective way to manage this relationship?
I think it's a different way. I think it's like, in some sense, to use an overused phrase, it's sort of too soon to tell which approach will yield bigger results. We'll see what the deal-making approach yields if an agreement is reached in the next several weeks. The WTO and WTO cases actually have their own limits. Domestic subsidies are permitted under the WTO. You have to wait until you can demonstrate evidence of material injury. I'm sure that point will eventually come, but that would mean that until the Chinese competitor to the 737 and A320 is flying and taking market share, you don't have much of a legal case. And since the support isn't taking the form necessarily of a direct government check to subsidize every single aircraft, it can be hard to prove an actionable subsidy. It has to be a specific subsidy, has to come from the government. If, say...
Wait, so sorry, I just want to understand. The subsidy is not inherently a violation of the WTO rules unless you can prove harm.
Correct. Harm to your export interest or...
And then to turn it back around, once you feel that you can prove harm, you've got to show that it was a subsidy.
Right. And the complexity of showing that it is a specific subsidy, as opposed to the argument that anyone who receives credit from the China Development Bank is subsidized, you really need to show that there was a special subsidy provided to this sector. And it was designed for government checks, for writing a check to your soybean farmers for every bushel of soybeans they produce. If China sets up a state company and it has a state investment group make an investment to give it some equity capital, is that a subsidy? It's actually not clear. You have to prove that the terms of the equity were not on market terms. It gets complicated, and I think that's been one of the criticisms of the application of the WTO to China, that in the Chinese context, proving a specific subsidy has been hard because subsidies themselves are so pervasive. And then it is very hard to bring a case saying that Chinese state airlines discriminated against Boeing's in favor of the Chinese producer. It need not be written down. You know, China doesn't write a quota and say, we will not import your aircraft. It's just the orders go in a certain direction.
I wish you could see the futility with which Brad Setzer is shrugging his shoulders to indicate the probable success of this approach.
Look, there will be a case. I'm sure that there will be evidence of a specific government subsidy to the C-919. The legal case would evolve slowly. And by the time that legal case is brought, China will have a competitor to the 737. It won't be as good as the newest generation of 737s. It won't be as fuel efficient, but that industry will have developed.
Well, let's look at what's actually on offer through the deal-making approach. The most significant one that seems to be verified is that China is willing to stabilize its currency. Is the yuan the problem right now?
Well, yes and no. The yuan was clearly a big part of the problem before the global financial crisis. China was intervening on a rather unprecedented scale to keep its currency from appreciating. It continued to intervene pretty heavily, actually, in 2010, 2011, 2012, even 2013. After 2014, the dollar moved up quite significantly, and that really has changed the equilibrium. Since 2014 and since the dollar appreciation, China has both intervened to limit appreciation at some points, but more frequently intervened to limit depreciation. Now, does the currency still matter for trade? Absolutely. It still defines the incentives that companies have to when they have to choose between producing a product in China or producing it in the U.S. Would it matter if the yuan were to depreciate further? Because it did fall some this past summer. Would that have an impact on the trading relationship? Of course. Did China commit to something all that substantial in the latest currency deal? Probably not. It seems like China has committed to do more or less what it has been doing since last September, which is keeping its currency basically stable.
Is it possible that this is an issue where U.S. incentives and Chinese incentives are aligned?
I think that was the idea behind what you might call the old deal on currency. China wanted its currency to play a bigger role in the global economy. It wanted to kind of grow up, be part of the IMF's reserve currency basket, the SDDR. It wanted a currency that seemed more like the other leading currencies. The other leading currencies float. The Fed and the ECB don't spend their day in the market trying to influence the euro-dollar exchange rate. And the PBOC, I think, had an institutional desire.
The People's Bank of China.
People's Bank of China.
China Central Bank.
China Central Bank to become more independent. When you're managing your monetary policy, at least in part, to meet an exchange rate objective that comes from the State Council, you aren't a fully independent central bank. Now, there's other ways in which the People's Bank of China isn't a fully independent central bank, but there was a sense in which having a floating currency and a more independent central bank matched the PBOC's desire. It would match the State Council's desire for a more globally prominent currency. And a floating yuan would match the U.S.'s preference at the time for a China that had a more market-determined currency. And the hope was that that would be a stronger currency. I think the New Deal is based on a different set of calculations. China never really successfully transitioned to a freely floating currency. Its currency has been quite heavily managed. The techniques of management have evolved, but the fact that China's currency is managed hasn't changed. China never got to that freely floating currency. And with the weakness in China's economy and with the strength of the dollar, the general direction of pressure on the Chinese currency has been down. And so there is a sense now, I think, that both the U.S. and China recognize that they don't want a freely floating Chinese currency just yet. They don't want a currency that floats down. And so therefore, you can argue both sides have an interest in having a managed Chinese currency, so long as that management is to resist a depreciation that right now neither side wants.
For a time, China had this incredibly high savings rate, 45%. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was looking for some sort of reliable asset. You know, we can talk about currency manipulation, but it just needed to go somewhere. And so it went into treasuries. That's shifting. And that's something that I've learned from reading your work, is that China has better investments domestically. And so some of that saving is going into domestic companies, sort of in the way that it should, right? You have your savings, it goes into, it becomes capital, it becomes an investment. Is that a trend that will continue? How long will it take until China becomes the classical macroeconomic model of a larger economy where capital sort of stays domestic because it has things to do domestically?
I never actually thought the Chinese economy fit the model of Chinese savers couldn't find safe Chinese assets, so they were buying treasuries. That's a story where the central bank isn't the buyer. That's a story where individual Chinese savers want treasuries. What was actually happening is that savers wanted Chinese bank accounts. Chinese bank accounts had a higher yield than treasuries. And the central bank, in effect, borrowed from the banks and invested abroad and took the currency risk. I think what has happened as interest rate differentials have gone down, as China's economy has slowed, frankly, as Xi's anti-corruption campaign made some part of the Chinese entrepreneurial class nervous, more Chinese savers actually wanted to put their money naturally abroad. And when Chinese savers want to put their money abroad, they go into real estate, they go into bank accounts, they actually don't tend to go into treasuries. So the notion that the Chinese savers were looking for safe U.S. Treasury bonds never was quite true. Chinese savers for a long time believed in the Chinese growth story and wanted to keep their money at home. China's government had to move their savings abroad to keep their currency undervalued. What's happened is that Chinese savers have lost a little bit of their confidence in China's growth model, and that is naturally putting downward pressure on the yuan. That's what, in some sense, changed 4 or 5 years ago. And that's why you just don't see the consistent large-scale intervention that you used to see. Yeah, also China's trade balance has come down. All that, China has mobilized a lot of money for domestic investment. It's just not always productive investment.
So I had this story wrong. I thought that there were more productive investments domestically, and that's why more capital was staying domestic. That's not the case.
I wouldn't characterize that. I think you have to think of the flow into treasuries as a byproduct of Chinese financial repression, that during that period of time, China was in some sense preventing Chinese savings from flowing into Chinese investments. They didn't want their economy to overheat. And subsequent, in the past few years, as China's economy has slowed and Chinese interest rates have come down, there's just been less willingness on the part of Chinese savers to keep their money at home.
Brad Setzer, thank you.
Sure.
That was great. Thank you.
Yeah. I don't think I solved the Boeing problem, but I mean, it's just a case where
but it's
interest
not solvable.
It's not solvable, so people don't like to talk about it, but it's huge.
Big grown-up countries want to fly their own airplanes. It's why France and Germany have Airbus. What I took from that conversation, though, was that China's story has changed. It intervened in its currency markets in the past, but that's not the problem now. Private Chinese saving went through China's central banks to buy treasuries, but that's not the problem now. China has its own domestic politics and also its own domestic economic cycle. They, too, are changing by the year. We wanted to figure out where China is right now in that cycle, and so Colby Smith of AlphaVille and I called Freya Beamish. She's the chief Asia economist of Pantheon Macroeconomics. There is official data about China. There's also real data about China. We read Freya to understand the difference between the two, and we asked her just where China is right now in its own cycle.
So the main indicators that we have to show that China's in a slowdown, at this stage in the game, certainly the PMIs, the surveys from purchasing managers have shown a very sharp slowdown, a very sharp downtrend, both the official gauge and the Caixin gauge, which is by a third-party provider. So that's what we have at the moment in terms of the survey data. We're sort of in a bit of a data black hole for the first 2 months of the year because of Chinese New Year. You can adjust the data, but unfortunately, sometimes the authorities just don't publish it. So in terms of the activity data, there's a reduced flow. But even before the beginning of this year, that is to say in the second half of last year, you can see that China is slowing just by looking at nominal GDP growth. And that's sort of my favorite starting point for looking at GDP, because it's probably less susceptible to manipulation.
And just to jump in here real quick, nominal GDP growth is real GDP growth plus inflation.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the inflation part or the deflator in China's statistics that we don't believe. So they start from the nominal GDP. The nominal GDP has its problems, but at least I think its problems are sort of consistent from quarter to quarter, and they're not quite so susceptible to any kind of manipulation. So
interesting. So they're playing, or it's by not backing out the deflator that you're removing their ability to muck with the numbers.
Yeah. So we use their data on prices, the CPI, we use fixed asset investment prices, we use export and import prices, but then we compile it into our own GDP deflator. And we use that to strip out the price effects in the nominal GDP and try to get down to what's happening in real GDP growth. And in Q3 of last year, that's when we saw the big drop in real GDP growth. And the second half overall was very weak. So we can tell even from that, even in the second half of last year, that China was going through this slowdown. And then looking beyond China, we can see the manufacturing cycle is slowing. We can see exports to China from the likes of Japan and Korea, which is at the beginning of the supply chain, and also publishes very early in the cycle. So these guys are really showing a sharp slowdown, even a contraction by this stage in the first part of this year in exports, and that's driven by China. So these are the kinds of indicators that that we can look at to see that China is in a slowdown.
And this goes far beyond the trade war effects here. I mean, this is a reflection of some, you know, internal struggles that China is having economically. So can you speak to, you know, some of the driving forces behind this slowdown?
Yeah, absolutely. So over kind of the second half of 2016 and through 2017, we saw a very sharp tightening of monetary conditions. That basically is just telling us the amount of cash that's available to buy goods and services, to buy assets, has been growing at a much slower pace. Typically China needs money to be growing much more rapidly than nominal GDP growth if we're going to see an upswing. And what we've seen is this very sharp slowdown in M1 growth, which is the best indicator over shorter periods of that liquidity that I've just been talking about. So this is really the kind of the key proof of or the key signal that we were going to see a slowdown in China. But the trade tariffs have come kind of on the back of that as a nasty sting in the tail. And it's possible actually that Chinese exporters and importers have sort of overreacted to that, and we have seen a massive downtrend in the import sub-index of the official purchasing managers index, which is a survey done to kind of get a gauge on the broader manufacturing sector. But it has a good lead on China's own trade data and also on the exports of countries countries that China trades with, as in exports to China. So this indicator that started to be badly affected by the trade tariffs, but it does, I'd like to emphasize, go beyond those tariffs. The drop in imports that we've seen in recent months, that's probably is not getting better anytime soon, and it probably won't see a pickup in year over year import growth. China's year over year import growth into well into the second half of this year.
So let's turn to the tools they have now to deal with this. You've said before that they're reluctant to use the old tools of, you know, extending credit, firing up the old state industries for a couple of reasons. One is that they want to move beyond that model. And two is that those industries pollute. And three is that they sort of know longer term that they have a problem with too much credit in the economy. So given that that's a tool that they don't want to rely on the way they did in 2015, and certainly not the way they did in 2009, 2010, what are the new tools that they're trying out now to deal with what is a cyclical downturn with what you call a sting in the tail from tariffs?
Well, I think what China's facing now is the kind of the crash of the short term with the long term, and they really are kind of, as we're speaking, making those decisions as to whether they prioritize growth or whether they continue to prioritize that longer term problem of the debt build up and the need to deleverage. And actually, the authorities have come out recently and said that they've hit their key targets that they wanted to hit in terms of debt ratios and stabilizing those types of ratios. But that doesn't mean that China's going to just go back to the kind of even the 15-16 type of stimulus, and certainly not, as you said, the kind of the 2009 post-financial crisis type of stimulus. The types of tools that we've seen them using in terms of on-balance sheet are very much tax cuts rather than expenditure. Expenditure growth has picked up, but it's been a kind of a faltering recovery. And it's not really been of the same order of magnitude as in previous cycles. Whereas tax revenues actually fell year on year in Q4 last year, and that's a result of both VAT cuts and personal income tax effective cuts and broader kind of cuts in fees and the tax burden for businesses. So that's the kind of the on balance sheet side of it. The off balance sheet side of it, we are seeing a pickup in the kind of the local government financing vehicle debt issuance, bond issuance, the growth in those indices. The number of public-private partnership projects has picked up. We can't really see very well the government-guided funds, and this was a major plank of the 2015-16 stimulus, but that probably, judging by the other off-balance sheet channels, is picking up. And also we expect the special bond issuance from local governments to be much larger this year than last year, and those are the types of bonds that are associated with infrastructure growth. So there is a bit of the old guard kind of infrastructure side of it in there. Environmental protection and kind of regeneration is a bigger plank than it has been previously. But in terms of the on balance sheet stimulus on the fiscal side, it's very much more on tax cuts. The monetary side has been kind of conventional easing, but the shadow banking side of it, they've very much kept the screws turned tightly on.
So Freya, you've said that the tariff war right now is actually having an effect on China's growth. It doesn't explain everything, but it's a piece of it, which means that the U.S. has some leverage in these trade negotiations. What is China willing to compromise on, and what is China completely unwilling to compromise on as they continue these talks?
I think China is willing to compromise, broadly speaking, because of the kind of the economic weakness that we've talked about. I actually think that the U.S. side is willing to compromise as well. I think Mr. Trump comes to these talks in a politically weaker position as a result of the midterm elections, and also as a result of the very clear message that markets have sent that they need some kind of clarity on the trade front, and the government shutdown was just a kind of an extra impetus to produce some kind of a win. So both sides come to these talks needing to produce a win. I think that the trade surplus side of this is incredibly complicated. In the short term, that probably they will China's trade surplus with the U.S. will reduce slightly as they restart purchases of the likes of soybeans and energy from the U.S. And we do think that that will happen. But kind of looking on a broader basis, China's slowdown is cyclically speaking is much more severe at this stage in the game than that of the U.S. So the kind of that cyclical pull is towards a larger trade surplus for China in general. And once we get over that kind of restarting of purchases of U.S. imports, that will apply to the bilateral trade surplus with the U.S. as well. Kind of looking longer term, I actually can't see how we get to the stage where you eliminate this trade surplus. China is an excess savings economy, and that means that they produce much more than they can consume at home. Saving is just an indicator of deficient demand if it's in excess, and if saving is in excess. So that deficiency of demand relies on an excess of demand somewhere else. Now, China is a high savings economy and the US is a low savings economy. So it's quite hard to see how you end up eliminating that that trade surplus over the longer term.
Well, it seems like there are several issues that are being conflated with the trade talks. One of them is the trade balance, which is a consequence of other things. One of them is intellectual property theft, the business climate, something that both U.S. companies and European companies have become frustrated with in China, that they can't sell into that market unless they either give up their technology or have it stolen, but either way, it's lost to them. Then there's stuff that's even more nebulous and it's hard to find, but foreign companies find when they're in China, various barriers to entry. And then on top of that, there's, you know, the aspirations of China to move up the value chain, which is not something that you could begrudge any country, you know, and that's sort of various state support for industries and industrial policy. And one of the things that I wonder is it possible or even likely that the U.S. will be able to ever address this last point of negotiation, which is that China does have an industrial policy like many countries do, and it does aspire to move up the value chain. It does want to build its own airplanes. And it's very difficult for any country, even the U.S., to say, you can't do that. You don't get to be that kind of an economy.
This is exactly why over the kind of medium to longer term, I still have qualms that these problems will ever die down. In the short term, I think there can be common ground found on those other issues, the intellectual property theft, trying to find some way of enforcing a more pleasant environment for foreign companies in China, and all of the kind of the things that have been stumbling blocks in talks, particularly because China does want to move up the value-added chain, then there is now a domestic lobby within China for stronger protection of intellectual property. And actually, the U.S. administration has started to recognize that in certain aspects as well. But this longer-term problem that China will move up the value-added chain and is a huge economy does put it on a collision course with the United States. Going back to this idea of China being an excess savings economy, now that the kind of the old guard industries, which are lower value added, are kind of over indebted, they're over polluting, and China needs to move and redirect that flow of savings into investment in the kind of the new industries, which are the higher value added industries, which is going to put it on a collision course with the US. So yes, China has kind of dimmed down the made in China 2025 rhetoric, but the reality of the situation is that it will continue to have excess savings, and they will be kind of channeled towards the higher value added goods, and that's a problem in terms of relations with the US.
And another sticking point here for China and the U.S. has been the currency. And we've seen a lot of attention lofted on the renminbi to dollar exchange rate since Trump took office. And long before that, even with a lot of the other administrations, you know, calling foul on China for, you know, manipulating its currency. And so the stable currency component of the trade deal that we saw about a week ago make headlines. What does that actually entail? And does that mean that the renminbi is moving away from being a market-determined currency? Not that it ever really was, but that officials now have the green light from the U.S. to very much intervene with the level of their currency?
This part of the negotiations is one of the most worrying. I think there is enough common ground there for a trade deal to be reached. But when the news came out about demands for a stable renminbi, this was a kind of a worrying moment. I don't see how China could credibly commit to that kind of a move to keeping the renminbi stable. We don't know what they meant by keeping the renminbi stable. And there's, as I said, there's a lot on the table beyond just this part of the talks, but ultimately a commitment to keeping the renminbi stable would be also a commitment to either burning foreign exchange reserves or just allowing the Fed to set monetary policy for China. And I don't see why China would want to commit to either of those things. The renminbi, to my mind, is on a long term depreciation path. On a real effective sense, and if they're going to commit to keeping the RMB at these levels, which is not necessarily exactly what was meant by those media reports, but if they were to commit to keeping it at these levels, it would be quite a drag on their economy, I think, and one that I don't think that they would be willing to accept. So I hope that stability meant no kind of overt attempts to depreciate the currency. But the problem is, as soon as any kind of tariff tensions reemerge, then there will be downwards pressure on the RMB, and that's just a kind of market-driven fact, really. So I don't see how China could really credibly commit to it, keeping the renminbi stable in those circumstances.
I mean, in a way, the U.S. is asking China to commit to solving a relatively old political problem, which is that there was a perception for a long time, a valid one in the U.S., that China was devaluing its currency, intervening in currency markets to sell more goods to the United States. So what you have is a long-term frustration on the U.S. side that wanted China to stop intervening in its currency markets. And what you have now coming out of these negotiations is an unclear promise to intervene in its own currency markets if necessary to keep things at a level that the United States would like.
It's kind of ironic, really. Yeah, I don't see China as being a currency manipulator in the way that these kinds of demands would suggest. I don't think it's been a currency manipulator in that sense, really, since about 2011, 2012. In fact, it's been trying to keep the currency strong for a lot of the period that has elapsed since then. So in that sense, this part of the negotiation is perhaps Mr. Trump's and other people in the administration's long-term bugbears over manipulation that's emanated from Asia over several decades, but is no longer actually a current story. In fact, it's been the opposite.
Freya, there's an event coming up, the two sessions meeting starting next Sunday.
Yeah.
In China. Help us understand the significance of that meeting, but also what might come out of it that we can look for in the coming months.
Well, the two sessions, a lot of it is just kind of the leaders saying what they have done for several years and reaffirming their kind of commitment to the Communist Party and a lot of waffle, to be honest. But there often are quite serious moves made at these meetings. Last year was a case in point. This was when Xi Jinping made his kind of great power grab, and there was a huge shakeup of the party and state bureaucracy. We can't can't really expect the same type of thing to happen this year because last year's was just such a large, a big change. But there are several kind of indicators that we should be watching for to get a gauge of the balance between that the aims of stimulating the economy and the longer term aims of preventing a further buildup of bad debt. Also the trade talks, we might get some indication of where we're going with those more structural issues that we talked about. There is actually a law up for consideration that would ban forced technology transfers. So there's plenty there to look out for on the trade talks side of it as well. In terms of the kind of the miscellaneous items, which there's a huge list of reforms that we're looking for in China, one that's received a bit of talk recently is the land rights for farmers, and that potentially would be a way of releasing a lot of productivity growth in the agricultural sector in China, which is going to be important in terms of building a more kind of self-sufficient economy, particularly with regards to the likes of soybeans and pork. So these are all things that we'll be looking out for, and then more broadly the economic targets for this year, and these are further things that we're looking out for.
Alpha Chat is produced by Dan Richards at the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance and Amy Keene from the Financial Times. We'll be posting show notes on Alphaville with links. We do want to understand when you listen, what you want to hear. Email us at alphachat@ft.com. I am working through a backlog of those emails to the German PhD candidate who wished we'd put an actual German on last week's episode, Das tut uns leid. For my part, I'm going to start following nominal GDP growth in China. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.